Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Now, Dennis Cagney and Dr. Tony Bates, you're both very welcome.
Thank you very much, Brendan.
So will I just explain first to people what's going on here? Because this is a bit different, but I think it's absolutely magic. I think this is like a film in a way. So Dennis, you're a neighbour of mine, right?
Right?
Now all the neighbours will be wanting to come in now, but you're a neighbour of mine. A couple of years ago, you asked me for a phone number for Dr. Tony Bates. And of course, Tony is a regular guest here on the show in his role as a clinical psychologist. But it turned out that you and Tony had known each other in school, but you hadn't been in touch for I think, for 50 years or more.
50, yeah.
Yeah. And now a lot had happened in both of your lives in all that time, including that, Dennis, you were diagnosed with motor neuron disease 5 years ago, just a year after you retired.
Sure.
Since that fateful phone call 2 years ago, you guys have rekindled your friendship all these decades later.
Yeah.
So we asked you both to come in against your better judgment to talk about friendship, life, aging, the past, and I suppose the power of memory as well. So, Dennis, how do you remember Tony as a boy?
Okay.
What?
Tony, okay, my image of Tony as a boy, he was polite, well-spoken, intelligent, baby-faced. In other words, he was the kind of boy your mother would love to see you bring home. Why can't you bring home fellas like Tony Bates instead of some of the other rogues? But also, apart from that, he was a little bit different in his range of interests. In the school we went to in Marino, sport was a big thing, hurling, football, putting on the school play and that. But then I said, I'd love to know more about classical music. I loved classical music, even though I can't play anything. And I said, I wonder if there's anybody I could talk to. And of course, this is where Tony came into the picture. And I remember I used to go up to your house some days after school, and you would play records. And you knew a lot more than I did at the time. I remember in particular, you gave me a class one day on the difference between program music and abstract music. Now, this was a young whippersnapper trying to absorb this. I remember you played the 1812 overture for me. You said, now, Dennis, in your real professorial voice, this is program music. In other words, it tells a story. But now the real purists prefer abstract music. So, of course, I went away. My head was spinning with it. I remember one or two days
later. How old were you, Dennis?
I think I was about... But 14 or so.
14, 15,
yeah. Mm. I remember my parents loved playing opera highlights at home. So I remember a couple of nights later, my mother was playing something from Rigoletto or one of these things. And I gave her a little lecture. While she was listening to good music, there is a better quality of music. She was wondering, what on earth is this son of mine turning into a lateral. But that was my first experience of Tony.
Okay. And Tony, how do you remember Dennis as a schoolboy?
Oh, Dennis was the alpha male in the class. He was the captain of the football team. He was the brightest in the class.
Love flattery.
And
I was kind of
daunted by him because I was the sort of the nerd in the corner, you know, who was hardly ever spoke up. But Dennis was, I just remember this curly, blonde-haired, freckled boy who just seemed to beam across the classroom. Everybody loved Dennis. The teachers loved Dennis. He didn't give any trouble, but even if he had, he would have got away with it. You know, the rest of us got away with nothing. Christian Brothers, you know, were pretty severe. But he was very good and, you know... Dennis kind of misremembers a little bit of it because I remember I was running this in my nerdish way with one other person, a little classical music appreciation group.
Of course you were.
We had all of about two people would come to the meetings. And then Dennis came up to me and said he was vaguely interested, but he had, you know, with a lot of 1960s stuff going on, and he was totally happy with that. And I was amazed that he was even talking to me. You know, yeah. I mean, I thought this is like, I'm not one of the cool guys, and this is the coolest guy in the class is talking to me.
This is like an American high school comedy. Yeah, the jock comes
and
talks
to the nerd.
This is the
opening of the movie. You know? Yeah, this is it. And it was, and then he came to my house. Sure, God, we probably cleaned for a week before he arrived, and we were in class together as 8-year-olds. You know, we first in second class in Marino. We were there in the same class with Mr. Hayes and
yes, we had our teachers.
We had, and we went right up through. Yeah. So this, what he's talking about is his second year in secondary school. But we had known each other, but not like real close.
Yeah. Yes. No.
Dennis, do you recognize Tony's depiction of you as the alpha male?
No, it is. You do flatter me. I love sport. I was at junior level. And I played it for many years afterward, but I didn't have much talent. But alpha male, a bit of an exaggeration. But I suppose the significant point was that I got on well at school because I was fairly bright. And in those days, it was a hard regime if you weren't bright.
Yeah.
You know, it was easy for people like me, or yourself, Tony, really, to get through school. But if you weren't bright at school, it could be a cruel enough place.
Yeah, and a particular kind of bright too, I'd say, Dennis.
By clerical teachers and that, you know.
Yeah. And Tony, do you recognise Dennis's portrayal as you as this slightly professorial teenager?
I'm amused. I can't imagine myself even having that kind of confidence, but it's a nice image. Thank you.
Yeah.
I think I probably was putting on some airs and graces, you know, because I was a bit, I think, overawed to have Dennis there as my student of one listening to my lecture on programmatic music. So I think, you know, we were 14 and sure, God, none of us was that confident about what we were. And we were just trying on identities like different clothes, and
it is an age at which you are exploring things.
That's right.
You know, and rightly so, you know.
Dennis, you then, in the interim, in the last few years, I suppose, read Tony's memoir. And I think you found out a lot more about what was going on for Tony.
I was intrigued by it. Tony's memoir, the heart broken open.
Breaking
open, yeah. Little did I know that there was this trauma, and it was genuine trauma, going on in your house, which you have described very vividly. And here I was. This was right beside me in the same area in Marino. Yeah. This was secret lives just going on about which we had no.
Secret lives.
And of course, that's the way life was. Maybe it still is the same, but in those days, I think, it was more hidden than there is now. I mean, you know, that would have... But I was fascinated. This house I used to go to, Tony's house, and there was this family traumas.
And ye obviously kept up the front, Tony, yeah?
I think we just, you know, I think what you grow up with is what you assume to be normality, and everybody else is going through the same thing.
And there's also, the other point I'd make is that we had a little trauma, and I shouldn't say we had trauma in our own family. I don't know, the brother who died tragically in an accident. But when I look back at my own reaction, when you're young, you're getting on with your own life.
Yes, yes.
And maybe it's the survival instinct, but you don't want to know about traumas that are going on.
Yeah, yeah.
You can easily block them out of your mind. And so I blocked this out of my mind because you're growing up, you're trying to find your way into this grey world of adulthood and that.
It's interesting, because do you think nowadays that we define our lives too much around the traumas that happen to us, Dennis? That back.
Well, just. I wonder, do we exaggerate trauma? Now, that may sound a bit brutal, but I'm a great believer in resilience. And it's a thing I've had to deep into myself since I got my MND diagnosis 5.5 years ago. And Tony, you probably have a different perspective on it, but resilience is a great quality, and survival. Now, that's not to say that there are so many vulnerable people about who need therapy from people like ourselves. But you're always drawing on a mixture of that therapeutic help combined with the innate resilience that most of us have.
Mm.
Not all of us. I mean, there are some people who don't have it, and they should really. That's very tough on them.
So, Dennis, why were you keen to reconnect with Tony after 50 years? Do you want a sip of water at any point or anything? Am I talking you too much?
No,
or
you're not.
Let me know.
If I get out of breath, you'll know. Well, first of all, I bored my own family of three children and my wife, Margaret. I used to bore them silly, telling them so often, you know, classical music, you know why I love that? It was a friend of mine, Tony Bates, actually. And every so often they say, did you ever meet this fellow, Tony Bates? And that. So when I started reading some of your articles, and I found it, when I heard what you were writing, and I was fascinated by the subject matter, mental health, trauma, and that. No, I don't have particular mental health issues myself. I don't think so anyway. But I just took the initiative. I said, I must contact Tony, because we always felt very comfortable with one another as young fellows, talking about substantive issues.
Yes.
Not just who's going to win the FA Cup or anything, substantive issues. And thanks to yourself, Brendan, we got together, Tony and I. I asked you one day, Brendan, let Tony Bates know that if he's interested, his old pal, Dennis Cagney, would like to talk to him.
How did you feel when I asked you about that, Tony?
I remember the day well, and I was absolutely bowled over. And then I heard what had happened to Dennis, and that he was in a wheelchair, and that he was, life has changed. And so we met a few nights later on Zoom.
Oh, yeah.
But the moment I saw him, he was Dennis. He was right Dennis. It was him. It was just...
50 years on,
I know, but it was Dennis. And I could see it immediately, and I still see it, and it's great. And we've had some wonderful conversations. We've continued them.
Because, Tony, you said to me subsequently, I think you said, by the way, thanks for putting me back in touch with Dennis.
It's been terrific.
It's been so good for me, you said.
It's been terrific,
Why?
I love visiting Dennis and Margaret, and I guess I compare it. I said it to both of them recently. You know, it's when I visit you two, it's like sitting at an open fire. And I just feel the warmth, and I feel nourished, and I feel stronger. And we have great fun.
We have great fun.
Dennis, and I love him, and I don't pity him. I love him.
Oh, yeah.
And it's and Dennis doesn't do victim in an extraordinary, admirable way that, I'm not sure I could measure up to myself, but he is very courageous in the way he has taken this thing on. And so we have great conversations, and he asks some very stark, honest questions. So we have conversations that I think keep both of us alive, you know?
Yeah.
Dennis, what have you got out of the rekindling of the friendship?
Well, I remember the day that Tony first called around to the house. I was sitting out in the patio in my wheelchair, and I got this big hug and a kiss on my head from Tony, you know? And it was lovely. And within a few minutes, we were chatting away the way we had years ago.
So it fell away for you as well all the years. He picked up where he left off.
And of course, I think since I've had the motor neuron disease, I am more vulnerable. But by the same token, I'm even more appreciative of friendship. It was such a, in many respects, I'm a typical Irish man.
Yeah.
In my younger years, I wasn't good at being a friend. By that, I mean, I would maybe feel it's got on with people But I wouldn't take the initiative in that. It was only in about my 30s, or even later, that I appreciated you've got to make an effort there to actually make friends. And men, certainly of our era, I often think we were a bit too embarrassed or hesitant about saying to you, look, I'd like to meet you. Let's meet every Thursday, fortnight or something like that. I think younger men, my own children, I think, are better than we were.
Yeah,
embracing friendship.
And I presume friendship has taken on a whole other level for you as well since you've been sick, has it?
Yes, it has. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm getting by fine. Sometimes I get down inevitably with the MND. But friendship is a wonderful, it's wonderful for lifting my spirits up. And I don't need friends to come along and sympathise with me or ask me or dwell on MND and that. If they come along, we discuss politics, sport, fun, anything. But having one or two, or at most three people, who are happy to talk intimately with me about life and how my illness has affected me, that is great.
Yeah, okay. And you have chosen those people and they know who they are and
they know who they are. Yeah.
And can you have conversations with Tony that you possibly wouldn't have with other people as well? Because of the nature of his...
I can. But remember, Ben, I don't want detailed, intimate conversations with lots of people. Yeah. I want friendship, all right.
Yeah.
But you only need a couple of people.
Yeah.
To talk to you and that, you know.
About the dark night of the soul kind of stuff.
Yeah. You don't want it all the time.
And Tony, I know you very much approach Dennis as a friend.
Yes.
And not a patient.
Oh, God, not remotely. Right. There's no doctor patient here.
Is there an element that you might have been the right friend to come along at the right time as well, given your great kind of... your heart and your wisdom
Dennis and I were talking about this recently and I said, you know, we do have these great conversations. I don't feel remotely, it's not therapy. This is just talking about real crap, difficult stuff that we're both facing in our life in different ways. But I think I said to Dennis, how do you feel talking about this? And he said, well, you know, I can talk to you because you're a mental health professional. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, you won't get upset. You won't get... you know, shocked, you won't get. And I think that's the only thing that this, for me, what Dennis is sharing is very real and very valid and it doesn't shock me. And I think he senses in that way a comfort in talking about things. But it's not that I'm making him better or anything. There's nothing, that's not remotely there. We're just two guys shooting the breeze and just saying how hard it can be sometimes, life, this
and
thing.
Tony, you have one very important, you're a good listener. You know, I think having a good listener is very important. I did, a few years ago, I did some voluntary work with the AWARE organization. You probably know of them, they're people with anxiety and depression and that. I was on a helpline one afternoon a week, and I found that fascinating. We were given basic training. We did the standard thing about checking with people on the phone that they'd eaten well and had they gone out exercise, things like that. But often, all they wanted was a chat. They were lonely. The people, they just wanted a chat. I remember one man in particular, he knew what day I was on and he'd ring me up each week. And it was only a matter of within 5 or 10 minutes before he'd start talking about Tipperary hurling. When is it going to make the comeback and all that?
Yeah.
And you know, all he wanted, they were very satisfying talks because I knew that at the end of the talk each week with him, he was in a happier place. He got somebody who could listen to him reminiscing about a thing like Tipperary hurling, or it could be anything in that, you know. But it was the value of having a good listener. And that's what I value very much in Tony.
Thank you.
No.
And when people are hearing there about your voluntary work, you're just talking about being sporty earlier, and you're a big runner, big into cycling, all that. Your diagnosis 5 years ago, was it a terrible, terrible blow?
It was an absolutely shocking blow. I had no inkling of it. Absolutely no inkling of it. I knew one or two little things were wrong, little pains. I used to occasionally fall while I was running, a little pain in my thumb. And I went up, just on the off, I went up, I got referred to St. Vincent's. And I was given the initial diagnosis within about 20 minutes, the specialist said. It is all the indications of motor neuron disease. Then I got the second test, the blood test, second opinion, all that. But the day I got it, I could hardly drive home. I was so distracted. I got home. I told Margaret. I told my children. And I made a few phone calls that evening. I just wanted to do any telling, get it over and done with. And then the next day or two, I was thinking, I'm going to be strong about this. And people were saying, oh, Doug, Dennis, you're taking it well. And then that Saturday, I remember I used to meet that Saturday, a friend of mine, Hugh. We used to meet for a coffee around the Shelburne Road, outdoors. This was early COVID stages. And I was driving around there. And Brendan, your program was on. I remember this. You played one record. It was the old Paul McCartney number, Those Were the Days, my friend, with Mary Hopkins. Mm. As soon as I heard her opening, you know, it's a lovely voice and that, the tears welled up within me. And I had to just pull in on the side of the road, Shelburne Road, quickly. And just, for about 15 minutes, I just bawled my head out. Mm. I was, in other words, I was being nice to myself. I dropped this mantle of being hard and resilient and all that. I cried out for about 15 minutes on my own. Then I said, okay, got myself together, went around, met my friend Hugh. I never said anything to him as to why I was delayed or that, and got on fine. And the important point, the lesson I learned to myself was that it's no harm. Indeed, it's good sometimes to just indulge yourself. Yeah. Be kind to yourself.
Yeah,
I know it sounds so
absolutely
simple.
Absolutely, no. Yeah, do you feel the need to be stoic, like for, even for Margaret and for the kids and that?
I do.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. But like Margaret and I, I often talk to her about, we get on very well. We're very good pals, as well as being a husband, loving husband and wife. Same with my children. But the need to be strong, it's a guide to me. It's like the Viktor Frankl idea of life. The meaning of life is to have some meaning that you set yourself. And to me, it is, if I can bear this, I don't want to pull people down to my own level. You know, because I'm very much a glass half full type of person. Mm,
yeah.
That's not a virtue, it's just a fact of life.
Yeah. Mm.
And I don't want it to bring down people with me. And that, you know,
But back to that bit then of having a few people, like, can you talk to Tony because of Tony's unique position as a friend and also mental health? Do you talk to him about, like, what might be ahead and stuff like that, or do you think about that?
Sometimes you talk about that, yeah. Sometimes you do, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And I do think about death. I mean, it's, you know, why wouldn't I? Because I know it's nearer than it. I don't know, but, you know, I'll have to face it sooner rather than later, probably, you know?
Yeah. So, Tony, I would say you regard it as a gift to be there for, to be able to be there for Dennis for that part of the conversation.
Yeah, we've walked very gently along that path and talked. Dennis has said to me he's not afraid of death, and I've been kind of really struck by that. That I think, I suppose, like anybody in a listening role, and I'm conscious there are many people who are, you know, have that kind of role with somebody in their life who's going through a very difficult time. I think it's very important just to let the other person lead that conversation, particularly around issues around death, and you're following the conversation if that's where they want to go, but you're not leading that conversation.
Yeah.
Some people don't. Some people do. Some people get it all together and make peace and die, and some people don't. And some people just, it doesn't all come together. We have lots of idealized notions about these things. But actually, each person's journey, I think, is very personal. And I think our job is to accompany them, but maybe standing a little behind rather than ahead.
Okay.
You know? So I feel it is a real privilege to talk about these things. But it's fun to talk with Dennis generally. As he said, he's a fun guy. He's a half full person. I come away feeling more alive, when I'm with him, because we've talked about many things, and it's very important we're not dominating the conversation with, we'll go there occasionally or we won't. It's fine. I'm very happy.
And I don't want to harp on it, but I just want to ask you one more question about it, Tony. Is it sad for you sitting there? You got back this guy. You picked up where he left off after 50 years. That, almost as I say, it's kind of magic. Is it sad for you to think that this is probably finite?
I've always had a kind of a hard enough attitude towards life and death. You know,
okay.
Death is just what happens, and you know. Mm. Mm. I don't feel like that with Dennis. I wouldn't wish for anyone to that their suffering be protracted in some way. But I know I'll be heartbroken when he dies. And I know that. And I will lose any kind of objective, detached, philosophical, whatever. Oh. It'll be all gone.
I'll
miss you, buddy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's not all... darkness and bleakness.
Yeah.
I mean, the effects of it on me are sadness and frustration at not being able to do a lot of things that I would, you know.
What's the most frustrating thing?
Oh, that I can't get out and do my running.
Yeah.
Or
I feel bad. I meet you when I'm coming back from my short little run sometime. I'd say you were a professional runner next to me, but you always take an interest and kind of, but I always kind of feel slightly.
But I found that great for my mental health over the years, that if I was busy or anxious about something, just go up to Herbert Park, go down by Sandy Mount, go for a good run. And it's amazing how you and I have spoken about this, friend. It does clear up the head.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. And so that freedom is kind of gone for you.
That's
now.
That's gone, but you get reconciled to that. And it's not as if I'm being heroic or anything in that, but there's still an awful lot to enjoy in life. For example, when Ireland beat Portugal and Hungary a couple of weeks ago, I was just over the moon.
Yeah. Yeah.
MND or no MND, you know, one of my friends told me, Dennis, we'll have you as, you'll be the Troy Parrott of our group now, you know.
They told him this is his Troy Parrott moment.
Oh, my Troy. Sorry, that was it. That was it. Oh, yeah, today's program was my.
There's text here from people who know you, Dennis, and then people who know you now.
Yeah.
One person says, Dennis may not have been an alpha male in school, but he was by far our best actor, often getting parts before lads who were really brilliant. P.S. He's a great human being, and Margaret is a big, big sweetheart.
Absolutely.
It's lovely and poignant to hear Dennis's voice again. I used to work closely with Dennis professionally for many years when he was with the CRU. I shared his love of running. I thought of Dennis as an elder lemon to look up to in that sport, he says. I didn't know he'd come down with MND and wish him all the best in navigating his challenges. But it's uplifting to hear Dennis sound characteristically like Dennis. Great-humoured, philosophical, unsurely intellectual. I like that. Unsurely intellectual, and resilient to a fault. Someone else saying it's delightful to hear you reconnecting, and the interview is making them feel like I'm around the fire with them. Long may their friendship continue. Dennis, you wanted to end today with a song, and I think this is a song that's come to mean a lot to you. So it's John Denver Some Days Are Diamonds is the name of the song, which I didn't know. So tell me why the song.
Some Days Are Diamonds, Some Days Are Stones is the title of the song. And the title tells a lot. The song is about, if you listen to the lyrics, it's about, you know, you're going to go down and have down days and up days. Don't worry too much when you're in the down stage. You know, the next day or the following day will lift you up. Now, the lyrics of the song are rather somber, but I find the melody and the rhythm, they're very uplifting. And I think I love the way these two parts of the song play against one another. And I think it's a great song, and a song of encouraging people that if you are down today, there's nothing wrong with that. Tomorrow, chances are, let it lift you up. And I think that's what the song does for me.
Dennis Cagney and Tony Bates, thank you both so much. And we give the last word now, I suppose, on resilience, isn't it, Dennis,
to
John Denver. This is Some Days Are Diamonds, Some Days Are Stone. Thanks, guys.
When you asked how I've been here without you, I like to say I've been fine, and I do. But we both know the truth is hard to come by. And if I told the truth, that's not quite true. Some days a diamond, some days a stone. Sometimes a hard times won't leave me alone. Sometimes a cold some days a diamond, some days a stone. Now the face that I see in my mirror more and more is a stranger to me. More and more I can see there's a danger in becoming what I never thought I'd be. Some days a diamond, some days a stone. Sometimes the hard times won't leave me alone. Sometimes a cold wind blows a chill in my bones. Some days a diamond, there's a stone. Some days a diamond, some days a stone. Sometimes a heart. Some days a diamond,
at rte.ie.